Five, four, three, two, one, zero. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
PLD Space is a Spanish launch startup. Last October, they successfully completed a suborbital test flight of their Mira 1 rocket, reaffirming their ambition to be among Europe's top launch startups. We talk about that flight, their future plans on the way to orbital launch, and many other things with my guest, PLD's CFO, José Manuel Rodríguez. Enjoy.
My name is Rafael Rodkin, and I'm an investor and advisor to space companies. Just as a reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only, and nothing should be taken as investment advice. This podcast is sponsored by NanoAvionics, a satellite manufacturer and mission integrator. Their technologies enable many space companies worldwide to offer services that improve life right here on Earth, such as providing global connectivity, conducting Earth observation, or contributing to scientific discoveries. Check them out, and also check out my episode with their CEO and co-founder. Sadly, I am not a rocket scientist, but I'm an alumnus of the International Space University. ISU offers a number of educational programs about space worldwide. Check them out at isunet.edu.
And just some final things before we start the episode about ourselves. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, such as Apple or Spotify. If you want us help expand our work, you can do so and support us at www.patreon.com/spacebusinesspodcast, and we'll also put that link in the episode notes. And lastly, you can follow us on Twitter at podcast_space.
Hey, space enthusiasts, welcome back to another episode. And we're back talking about the launch sector in this episode. And I'm very happy to have as my guest, José Manuel Rodríguez, and he's the CFO of PLD Space from Spain. Welcome, José Manuel.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for hosting me in this episode of your podcast. I'm really excited to participate on this.
Yeah, same here. You had an amazing recent milestone, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But why don't you start, as we always start here, and you just give us like the sort of few minutes elevator pitch on what PLD Space is and what it does, please.
Yeah, I mean, PLD is one of the pioneering companies developing the launch, micro launch sector in Europe. We started the company like designing rocket engines, but basically we scaled up from that challenge in order to design, manufacture, and launch a rocket into space. So basically, we saw a point in the past that Europe is getting behind US developing this type of rockets. I mean, we all see that SpaceX or Rocket Lab are doing a great impact on the market in the US. But like 10 years ago, the two co-founders, Raul Verdú and Raul Torres, they identified that Europe is going to be challenging competing with this type of launches. So they decided to start developing this engine, that it was the first private company developing an engine rocket. And from that point, it's going to be an amazing story about how to develop from Spain a launch company. We are very proud to be the first company, private company, that has been able not only to develop, also to successfully launch a rocket like Mira 1, a suborbital rocket that basically are integrating, let's say, around 75%, 80% of the technology of the orbital vehicle that is going to be a Mira 5, that nowadays we are very focused on developing that orbital vehicle, but very, very comfortable and motivated because we did it with Mira 1. We developed most of the technologies that is going to be incorporated in Mira 5, and now it's a question of scaling up. We are not developing new technology. We basically are scaling up the technology developed in Mira 1 into Mira 5. From that point, obviously, we were very credible. I mean, we gained a lot of credibility on the market, because this market is very important to understand that credibility is very important, because there is a lot of concerns about the risk of developing that technology, safety. Many people always claiming that they are developing a rocket, but not all of them are so serious as we see in the market. I mean, they are also, they are obviously a lot of, or some of the competitors in Europe that they are doing a great job, but we think that we are in a very good position after we successfully launch Mira 1 in order to take the challenge, because it's still a challenge to develop Mira 5, an orbital vehicle. Mm-hmm. But starting or departing from the base that we were able to do it in a very proper way with Mira 1, we feel that we are very confident in order to be successful developing the Mira 5. Apart of that, obviously, we were also breaking a lot of rules in Spain, because in Spain, we never have had this type of technology or this type of industry. And we were very supportive from the institutions. We gained a contract with the government in order to support the development of Mira 5. And today we are already starting the development of the spaceport in French Guiana. That is going to be the first spaceport where we're going to execute the first launches of Mira 5. So very happy about the evolution and the milestone that we achieved in the last quarters in the company.
Let's take a step back. So when was the company founded originally? The
company was founded in 2011. So a long time ago.
And you were talking about the sort of the European access to space, right? And now it's sort of headlines everywhere that, and maybe for our non-European listeners, right? Europe actually at the moment doesn't have any access to space because previously the Ariane 5 rocket is retired and the Vega rocket is not, I guess, not really flying reliably at the moment. And but in 2011, that obviously was not the case. So there was sort of a very prescient, ambitious bet the founders made there.
Yeah, they were the two co-founders, Raul Bedu and Raul Torre, were very fans of the rocketry. They were fans developing these small rockets as a hobby. And they were enthusiasts about developing this type of technology. At that time as well, there were a guy in the US called Elon Musk trying to develop this this type of access to space in a different way. And they were really following that trend in the US, also in New Zealand, where the founder of Rocket Lab, he was starting at the same time, more or less, in New Zealand. And there were two or three guys just following Elon Musk's trend to develop this rocket from a private sector. And well, they decided to take the steps. I mean, they were even students in the university. They took the challenge to develop the propulsion, the rocket engine. But from that point, everything was evolving in a right way. So they decided to enlarge the challenge in order to follow that trend in the US. And finally, everything is confirmed. I think it's a trend that is not going to be back. I mean, also Europe is opening opportunities to these private launchers because it's a way to be more competitive with the Americans or the Chinese. And well, thanks to that ambition at that time, we are right now in this very good position.
And you mentioned that the founders started off, if I heard this correctly, also building engines, and then they expanded. So out of curiosity, if you know the history, like, I'm just curious who they were envisioning selling the engines to, given that there weren't really any rocket companies back then, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think at the beginning it was more R&D company oriented, like developing the design, developing the reliable rockets. And they were thinking at that time that the market is going to be like, okay, new rockets happening and selling those engines to those new rockets. But the
understood.
Market in the last 10 years has changed a lot. Now it's all the companies, all the successful company has been integrated vertically. Mm-hmm. So they were developing their own technology. So at this point, they have to also pivoting from that idea to a new idea of developing their own vehicle.
And that's sort of, that was going to be our next question, sort of closing off on the engine topic. So is that still part of the business models that you would also sell engines just as engines, or is it just now it's just focusing on the integrated vehicle?
No, everything is going to be integrated in the vehicle. I mean, we are not, Obviously, in our experience, when someone is visiting PLD facilities, they always see a lot of micro companies there. I mean, because we are integrating like a lot of companies into a very small company. We're still 180 people, but we are developing a lot of technology related to the vehicle. But end of the day, today, the challenge is still so big that we are not thinking on splitting different technology in different parts, different companies. The main challenge today is integrating all the technologies in Mirafy, because we see that the opportunity is not in the technology, is on providing the service to access to space. And I don't know, maybe in the future, coming 10, 20 years, maybe we are doing something different. But we have a very clear roadmap in the coming 10 years that the key point is going to be providing access to space to customers, not providing technology to some others companies. For instance, I mean, we have been approached from many companies that are developing different type of engines, and end of the day, it's going to be very difficult for us to be dependent on third parties, because what we demonstrate is that integrating the whole vehicle technology in one company give us a lot of strength, and we are not dependent on third parties, because we see some cases that launches has been splitted in order to make more simpler in different companies, and everything is relying on the supply chain. And sometimes the supply chain is not really at these days replying in a proper way. So we are very conscious about to be very competitive in terms of cost, in terms of time, and in terms of reliability. And the magic formula that we found is that we need to integrate all the key parts of the vehicle.
So you would say you're basically almost fully vertically integrated.
Yeah. Okay, we are designing, manufacturing, and testing engine structures, avionics, so all the key parts. Obviously, there are some part of the rocket that we are not very interested on developing. And if we see that there is an opportunity on the value chains with robust suppliers, because this is also very important. We have to develop this company in Spain or in Europe, where this type of industry, it doesn't exist yet. So we have to teach a lot of, in the past, we tried to do it in a different way. We have to teach a lot of suppliers, but end of the day, the economics is not working for us and it's not working for them, because it's still not a massive industry. It's a very, it's an industry that requires a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of capital, and and the returns of that is not going to be very quick.
Yeah, and it's like you said, it's virtually everybody I can think of who is currently flying has gone down this route of full vertical integration. The only exception that maybe comes to my head is in the US, the new Vulcan rocket now using Blue Origin engines, but Blue Origin is so big that arguably the supply chain risk is lower than if it was a startup company. But anyway, could you describe a little bit the both the Miura one, so the suborbital rocket you just flew, so just like some basic specs, you know, size, what kind of propellant you're using, what payload capacity was, and then also the specs of the orbital vehicle, the Miura 5, and then maybe sort of what you said it was just scaling up, but maybe if you know, what are the main challenges in your mind going from Miura 1 to Miura 5?
Yeah, Miura 1 is a suborbital vehicle rocket that is the height is something around 15 meters, 1 meter of weight. I mean, I can't remember now the tons, but it's a small rocket. But they were integrating the first version of the engines, okay, the avionics and the structures, and all this technology that has been developed for Miura 1 is going to be scaled to Miura 5. So basically, we didn't only test the vehicle; we also test all the processes that we are doing in the factory and testing. So basically, we create a kind of a school for our employees as well in order to test everything. So the structures have been developed internally, and now we have to do with the same machinery, with the same process from Euro 5. The engines is going to be a new version of the engines, obviously with bigger units, and same for the avionics. Avionics is going to be very similar to the avionics that we use in Euro 5, because we identified that the avionics is a very critical part and they were working perfectly. So the deviation that we have during the mission was very, very small, very residual. So we were very happy on that. Even we didn't, because the target of the rocket was not to achieve orbit, but we were just testing how it's going to be the guidance of the rocket. And was a completely success of that part of the subsystem. But also, we were very confident that we are a company that is obsessed with the testing. We test everything. We develop our own testing facilities here in Spain, in an airport that is based in Teruel, in the region of Aragon. So we were very fast designing, manufacturing, and testing, and going in circles in that way until we were very happy with the results. And this is also reflected in the success of the Mira 1, because we were not having any hurry to go to the launch pad. We were very very conservative in that way. Until everything is tested hundreds of times, we are not put it in the launch pad. So basically, all these type of processes, internal process and product assurance policies that we were applying for Mira 1 is the same that we are applying for Mira 5. The challenge of Mira 5. Mira 5 is going to be a orbital vehicle with a performance between half a ton and 1 ton, depending on the orbit that we are launching and the spaceport. And the main challenge that we have is that basically it's going to have 5 engines. Basically, instead of one. So we have to do a lot of re-engineering the things, testing everything, and it's going to be a two-stage rocket. So basically, one of the things that we are working now is on the separation stuff that we need to develop for Mira 5, that in Mira 1, we didn't have to face that challenge.
And what's the propellant? Is it
RP-1? Yeah, we are using the propellant is kerosene, so the same propellant that airplanes are using. And one of the innovations that we are working for Mira 5 is, instead of using basic kerosene, we are developing with Repsol. Repsol is an oil champion company here in Spain, a biokerosene, in order to even be less. To produce less carbon footprint when we are launching the rockets. That is going to be probably one of the innovations that Mira 5 is going to have. Probably not in the first flight, but from flight 5 to 10, we are going to incorporate this type of propellant.
So one major step, obviously, is going to be the bigger engines. What's the status of, have they been tested yet, or where are you along the sort of the path towards the Mira 5?
Yeah, nowadays we are prototyping those engines, and they are starting to do the first tests. I mean, probably very soon we will be announcing something when we are probably being successful with the testing. But I mean, a couple of weeks ago, 1 month ago, we start to do the testing of those first prototypes. So, and the magic of this is that in order to produce or to manufacture the first engine of Mira 1, we took months or years. And in order to produce the first unit, the first prototype of Mira 5, we only took a couple of months.
So this kind of leads to the next question, which is, is any good rocket company, obviously you want to fly ideally very often, right? And previously there have been these, I think it's very fair to say, and everybody realizes this now, some unrealistic projections by some companies in the US saying we're going to fly like 300 times per year and so forth.
From sort of your company planning perspective, I assume you're setting up some, maybe you already have set up some sort of nice, basically factory, right? Yeah. Where you can, I don't want to say mass produce, but maybe like to say volume produce these rockets. How many rockets do you think you'll be able to produce per year? And then so how many times ideally would you launch per year?
Yeah, we are now anticipating a lot of investment in terms of, for example, manufacturing and testing in order to be able to produce at least 30, 35 rockets per year in 2030. So basically, we are very conscious of the ramp up of our launch company that basically we will start launching not many rockets the first year, but we want to increase our capacity in terms of spaceport and in terms of manufacturing capabilities. And the target is going to be able to produce at least 30 rockets per year in 2030. So this is a challenge, but it's something that we think that is going to be achievable in the coming 10 years. Obviously, if we can improve because the demand is there, we will do it. But the capabilities, I mean, all the investment that we are doing now is in order to produce between 30 to 35 rockets per year.
Is there, obviously sort of the challenge of scaling up is a challenge that many companies face. Is there something you would like to highlight that sort of interesting aspect of, a particular challenge within the challenge of scaling up, something that's particularly difficult?
One of the things that we identified is that once you have launched a rocket as Miro one, I think the technical challenge is not that big. I think the main challenge that we have as a European company is the financing, because it's not that easy to finance a company like a launch rocket, because you have to anticipate a lot of investment in a pre-revenue status. So this create a challenge in order to attract investors. And this is one of the things that we are improving or focusing right now in order to finance the coming 2-3 years that is going to be very capital intensive. And things are improving, obviously, in Europe because they realize some institutions and investors that in order to compete with the Americans, we need to invest right now. Otherwise, we're going to lag behind them. And there is more people listening that this is an investment that it makes sense, obviously, on the medium long term. I mean, because investing in a launch company has to be passion capital. I mean, we don't need capital that they want to exit in 2-4 years, because end of the day, this, we are not creating only a company, we are creating a capacity for Europe and Spain, and also this capacity is going to be very important in the coming years in order to compete with some other regions that they are doing very good. I mean, it's. I was watching a graph last week. US has launched last year 100 rockets, China around 60, 70, and Europe was able to launch a couple of rockets. So, and this is very sad to see, because there is a wall industry, a wall space industry, like the satellites and applications that are dependent of the space satellites, that nowadays they need to go and fly with the Americans because they don't have an alternative here in Europe.
Yeah, and I suspect, I mean, if I put on my head as a space VC investor, I wouldn't be surprised if very soon, if it stays like this, countries like India will hugely overtake Europe if you don't make the investment now. So is it, are you satisfied? I mean, like you said, there's some movement now in the institutions, right? And ESA has a new program basically to give out launches. So I guess you mentioned like stuff seems to have started moving a little bit in the right direction. Are you satisfied yet? Or are you sort of comparing with other countries? Do you think there's something else both the national as well as the European governments could do to help the sector?
Yeah, I mean, we have to understand the how the things are in Europe. I mean, changing things in Europe are a little bit more complicated than the US. And I mean, in the US, I mean, many launches companies has been appointed with some contracts in order to speed up the development phase. Here in Europe, we are having some initiatives like the Ticket Initiative sponsored by the European Commission and European Space Agency that give access to launches like PLD to provide that service with the sponsor of the European Commission. It's a first step. Obviously, we will need to increase that initiatives in the coming years, but I think we are moving the things in the right step. As a PLD, we would like to have more support in this part because obviously to develop a rocket company, as a CFO, I would like a faster collaboration between the private and the public institutions, because end of the day is going to be very important at this stage, the support of public institutions in order to attract private investors as well. And, you know, things are moving in the right direction, but probably I would like, if you ask me a wish, I would like to have more speed on that probably we will see in 2025 or 2026, all the initiatives that are starting to be implemented today are going to be growing in a proper way in the coming years.
Understood. So speaking of contracts, so shift over to the sort of the markets and the customers. Do you have a notion yet, sort of like who you think your first customers will be? And if you don't want to give any names, so maybe like the types of customers, is it going to be government missions or commercial or a mix?
How we see the market, I mean, we are approaching the market right now in order to establish the first contacts with potential private customers, because I think we as a mandate, we need to test the market price, feasibility, interest, and everything. But we understand that the first missions that we have to be very clear on that. The first mission are going to be riskier after you need to develop a track record in the launch sector, because otherwise insurance and prices are a bit higher. So basically what we see is that the first missions are going to bring some institutional payloads. I don't know from if it's going to be Spanish government or European governments or European Commission, but basically for this demo flights or first flight that we need to demonstrate a good performance and create a good track record, is going to be this type of payload. And obviously there will be a lot of private customer that they will be watching the performance of the rocket, because the demand is there. I mean, the demand is very clearly asking for new ways to access to space. They don't want to be dependent on only one player, and they want to have alternative. But obviously, to understand how this market works, you need to, first of all, gain some credibility, good launches, as we did it in Miro 1. And this also help the insurance company, that is always a part of the pricing, to give proper prices to fly with the Miura 5. So basically, they will see a lot of, as soon as we are able to deliver good flights or good launches, I mean, the price premiums will be much more stable for the customers in order to fly with Miura 5.
Yeah, and I think it's so important what you're saying, right? Sometimes people don't realize that. So because institutional demand is one thing, right? But then, again, if I wearing my hat in my day job as a VC investor, right, we have many startups that need to fly to space, right? And some of them have gotten burned, affected negatively by experimenting too much, right? So we had a startup that had its maiden launch on the Virgin Orbit launch out of the UK, and that probably set that company's timeline back by a year or so, right? So now people are understandably really quite careful. So as you said, people are obviously comfortable flying on SpaceX. I think they're comfortable flying on Rocket Lab, which has had, I think, 40 to 50 launches or so, right? They may be comfortable flying on the Indian vehicles. If you had to guess, what's your sense of how many successful launches you need before commercial people and are comfortable and the insurance is like 3 launches, 5 launches? I know it's a difficult question. Just sort of.
Yeah, it's always a difficult question, but what we are in PLD, what we are doing is we're going to have two demo flights that they will offer that payload to people that they want to take the risk, because two demo flights are two demo flights. And with those demo flights, hopefully it's going to be as successful as the Miro one, but we want to learn from those demo flights. So basically, if we do a two good demo flight, probably having two commercial flights, and the flight number five is going to be okay. But everything will be dependent on how are those demo flights performing. So basically, you need to at least 3 to 4 flights in order to demonstrate that your launch is right for the insurance company, that the one that they are very worried about, what type of rocket are you taking. And well, it's a question of gaining credibility. I know that the customer, they were obviously very concerned always about where they put their payload. And from the rocket company, one of the main, I would say that the first thing that we are always discussing when we are talking with the market is about reliability of the rocket. So availability and price are second and third option, but the first one is reliability of the rocket. That's why we are so obsessed in the company to test everything, to test, and test. And we see many companies that they were very quick going to the launch pad with a technology that probably shows that it's going to be flying, but once you press the button, the rocket needs to have as many warranties as possible in order to be successful. And this has been demonstrated with the Miura 5, with the Miura 1 fly as well. I mean, we were very obsessed with the test set. We were canceling a couple of attempts before the successful fly because we were very obsessed with the conditions, atmosphere conditions, security staff, and everything. And we were able to do it in the third attempt because we were completely sure that we maximize the options to be successful.
And sorry, I just realized I should have asked you one other question on the Miura 1. Is the Miura 1, so was it a step on the way to the Miura 5 and the Miura 5 is the focus, or do you envision continuing sort of like a sounding rocket type supplemental?
No. I mean, okay. Miura 1 is a program that is already ended. I mean, and the answer for that is very simple. I mean, we are a company that we are obviously scarce on resources. We have a number of engineers and we are not able to provide tasks. I mean, we are not able to develop or to maintain two programs at the same time. So, I mean, Miura 1 was a way to minimize the risk of developing Miura 5. So it was a program with a budget around 30 million euros. But we develop a lot of technology, we develop a lot of processes, and we develop as well a lot of the team, because we always forgot about the team. It's not that easy to experience or to give the experience to the team in order to manage a launch. And with the launch of Miura 1, we were able to demonstrate that the people that we have in the company are very competitive or are very experienced right now launching a rocket, not only developing, also launching a rocket.
That makes sense. Yeah, and I totally appreciate, again, as an investor, that you keep your eyes on the big prize, which is the orbital launch vehicle. So speaking of that, the Miura 5, if people are interested, and there's probably lots of space entrepreneurs listening to the podcast always, is there like a user guide out already, like indicative pricing? Like, are you ready for people to contact PLD and... about the product?
I mean, we have more than 500 million euros on the commercial pipeline with opportunities and conversation. We are having good customers. We are sharing the guideline and everything. So obviously there is a small business development team that are in contact with the customer, and we are providing a lot of information about how it's going to be the launches of Miura 5, because we already Have some idea about how many launches or the scheme of the launches that we are going to have in 2026 and 2027. So we are already having discussion with the customer in order to secure those launches. But as today, the development of MuraFi is still too early. For us, it's very difficult to close a date. Not because it's going to be risky for us and risky for the customer. We want to preserve the credibility with the market, same, very honest, because we also identify that there are many launch companies that they are saying they're going to launch in the next quarter, and after next quarter, they are moving up to the next quarter. And end of the day, I think they are trying to create some hype in the market that is not honest. We try to escape from that hype, and we try to be very honest with the customers as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, if you listen to some other podcast episodes, you may know every beginning of the year, I do a preview of the things that may, big space events that may happen of the year. And I swear there's probably a few launch companies whose first flight is there in the preview episode for the third year running. It still hasn't happened.
Yes, yes.
So we're all quite used to that. So if we take a step back and talk sort of about the launch market more in general, right? So obviously you have SpaceX currently with the Falcon 9, and then, you know, probably Starship on the horizon. We have other very heavy vehicles like, you know, Blue Origin, New Glenn may finally fly this year, or, you know, it may again feature in next year's preview episode. As you said, there's a number of other smaller launch companies at various stages. What's your view how the launch market is going to evolve over the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years? And where do you see the sweet spot for PLD?
Yeah, the sweet spot for us is very clear. I mean, we want to be very focused on those small and medium satellite operators that obviously they are not seeing the rideshare missions in SpaceX as inappropriate. I mean, obviously, there are many companies that they have to take this opportunity as that is the only one, but they see a risky missions being a piggyback or a rideshare in the SpaceX. And we want to be very proactive, providing the services, customized services to this type of customers. As you know, I mean, SpaceX and some of the Americans are getting bigger and bigger because it makes sense. I mean, to scale up the economics is very important to have a bigger rocket. But end of the day, there are also some small, medium satellite operators that they prefer to be in a very customized missions that are the ones that we are going to be very focus on in this type of customer. If you ask me about my view about how it's going to be the small launches market in the coming 10 years, there is a kind of agreement between many people that are involved in this market that they're going to only survive. I don't know how many they are promising now, but they're going to survive between 6 to 8 small launches between US and Europe, probably 3 to 4 in the US and 3 to 4 in Europe. And obviously you will have also competition in China and India. But the idea of small launches is not to compete with the big ones, is to be very complementary with the big ones. There will be some customers that it makes sense to go with the Ariane 6 or SpaceX or Starship, and there will be some customers that they will prefer to be with a very customized mission with the small launches. And this is going to be the target that we're going to have in the future. And hopefully, and we are very very proud of that, and hopefully we are going to be one of the Europeans that we are going to be competing in the coming 10, 20 years within the Europeans, but obviously taking a lot of opportunities, global opportunities, because we have customers or potential customers not only in Europe. We have a lot of traction, for example, in Middle East or in Asia, that they are very used to work to fly with a SpaceX rocket, but end of the day, they are agnostic. They want to have different options, and they will be probably one of the most active customers that we have in the coming years.
That's actually an interesting point. So talking about Middle East or other countries like this. So I think you mentioned you see your main business model as being a launch service provider. Do you ever see a scenario where maybe some sovereign country, they want to have a sovereign capability and they would want you to sell like actual like rockets just to them for operating?
Well, this is a question mark. Obviously, I mean, many countries, they see this as an important capability or a key capability. Mm-hmm. But they were, I mean, it's very hard to develop this type of services because you need at least 10 years, like PLD has demonstrated, in order to create this capability. It needs a lot of investment in terms of capital, in terms of time, in terms of many things. And it's obviously, as a country, it will need a lot of focus on developing that. And I don't see many countries developing that capacity. What I see as a private companies is sharing that capacity with different countries, because obviously it's a different framework right now. I mean, private companies are not just depending on institutional missions. They will be competing in institutional missions from the European Space Agency or NASA, but also they will have to look for opportunities everywhere. One of the things that you are seeing now in the market is what many countries are developing is a spaceports, and they want to attract launches to those spaceports, because it's still a challenge to develop a spaceport, but the challenge is a bit less than developing the rocket. So basically, what I probably see in the future is that those launches companies, and this is also a very interesting opportunity for the Europeans, because I see the Americans, as you can probably imagine, Americans is 60% of the space market. So the demand is huge there. So launches probably are not seen internationally as they are fighting in order to compete in the domestic market. But for the Europeans, that they have that capacity, launches, I think there is a lot of opportunities in Europe and overseas, because many countries right now are developing space agencies, are developing space programs, and they will need a launcher sooner or later.
So it's interesting you mentioned about the launch side, and it's true. We have seen several countries developing launch sites. So obviously, Andøya in Norway is an example, and I think there is at least two in Scotland being developed, and the Shetland Islands and so forth. I think you mentioned you guys were going to launch out of Kourou, sort of the European spaceport in French Guiana. How did you guys go about deciding the spaceport?
Well, I think the first one was a bit based on our route. I mean, we want to be launching from European spaceport, and having institutions like a European Space Agency and European Commission supporting us on the developing of the launches there. There was a lot of improvement as well on the operation of the French Guiana Kourou spaceport. We want to, obviously, one of the strategic things that our business plan needs to be securing in the coming years is, I mean, we are providing access to space, but we need to secure the spaceport where we are going to launch. So basically, we were in discussion with KNES for a long time in order to be one of the first private operators in French Guiana. And finally, we got an agreement. Now we are developing the spaceport. But we are obviously in contact with so many spaceports around the world, in Canada, Middle East, and in Andoya as well. And probably in the coming years, we will be announcing different spaceports that will give us access to new markets, will give us risk mitigation, because sometimes there is some problems in the spaceport and we need to mitigate that risk. And we will be more accessible to different customer needs, because sometimes the customer needs to fly from one spaceport, or some others from another one, in terms of the orbit and optimization of these type of things. And as a small company, we need to be flexible on that part, because it's a really an important factor of the company, to be very flexible with the customer and obviously to mitigate all the potential risk.
Yeah, so I was actually going to ask you about this. Is there any specific orbits you think you're going to be focusing on? Maybe orbits which are not going to be served so frequently by some of the larger launches?
Well, not, I'm not a specialist on that, but one of the reasons why we choose French Guiana is because we want to be, I mean, from French Guiana, you can target almost 90% of the orbits. And this is also part of the of our motivation as well. I mean, to be flexible to as many orbits as possible from French Guiana is one of the key important factors. But we want to reach different orbits and different inclination from many different spaceports. But this is a continuous improvement of the rocket and the capabilities as well. So we are not saying that tomorrow or the first flight of Mira 1 is going to be accessible to the all orbits. So we're going to have that flexibility in French Guiana, but obviously we will try to complement that orbits access with different spaceport in the coming future.
Understood. Do you think we'll see a Spanish orbital spaceport at some point?
There is some initiatives here in Canary Island, but it's always challenging as well. So basically, we are, I mean, as a rocket company, we are always collaborating with the institutions or companies that they want to develop a spaceport. But obviously, it's we understand the complexity of that. So basically, we try to help, but end of the day, we need a stable spaceport right now because our Mira 5 flight is going to start in end of 2025, and we are not really dependent of new spaceport that it needs to be developed in the coming years because it will take probably more time.
Yeah, and like you said, the most important thing is to get to show this reliability. You just need to fly, right? So there's no reason to take risk on spaceports in addition.
But we are very collaborative with all the institutions and companies that they try to develop a spaceport because we have some requirements that we can anticipate. And obviously, it's important collaboration between the spaceport authority and the rocket company as a newcomers to be in a collaborative way.
And so if we look at your timeline, right, so you have when did you say the first flight is currently expected? Was it 2026?
Yeah, it's expected end of 2025.
Okay, understood. Okay, so that's obviously a very significant milestone. Which other potential milestones do you see in the future? So obviously some other things that, you know, companies like SpaceX or even Rocket Lab have then worked on after they've established a successful heritage is, you know, things like reusability or bigger rockets. Is there something else on the PLD roadmap, you sort of like the 10-year roadmap you'd like to point out?
Yeah, obviously reusability is one of the key and important things of this type of business because it gives you a lot of flexibility as well. And also, as Raul Torres was mentioning in one of the conversations, also give a lot of credibility to the customer because some customers, they prefer to fly with a booster with some track record. And this is also from reusability. So we are very proud to be one of the first private company that has been proving reusability in a proof of concept with the European Space Agency. Now we are developing also with the European Space Agency a second version of that. So we are continuously improving the reusability. We are very conscious that this is not going to be from overnight to be reusable. There is a learning curve on that, but we are considering seriously to be reusable. And I don't know. It's difficult to give you forecast in which flight, but it's going to be there probably from the flight 10 to 20 or 25 that the Mira 5 is going to be fully reusable. And this is one of the key questions that we are going to, I think the most important of this is, first of all, to be reliable. So the first version is going to incorporate 100% of the requirements of being reusable. But it's very difficult to be successful on the first mission. So we'll probably learn from the first flight, we will learn from the second flight, and we will keep that track until we are completely sure that we can make it and we can recover and we can reuse it, because there are two different challenges. First of all is to recover the booster, and second, to reuse in the next flight. But this is a completely key milestone of the second phase of Miura 5. So first of all, demonstrate that we are reliable, and second is that we are able to reuse that part.
That makes sense. The other aspect, of course, of doing all of these things and growing and scaling up is on the team side. How many people are there now at PLD, and how do you see this evolving, and are you hiring actively right now?
Yeah, I mean, we are right now 180 people, and we are still hiring. I mean, we ended up last year around 130 people, so we increased the headcount by 50 people in less than 3 months, and we are still incorporating a lot of people. We want to be probably close to 200 or a little bit more than 200 end of the year. Because now you need to scale a lot of things. We are moving from a small warehouse where we manufacture Miura 1. We are also moving to a new warehouse very close to the current facility in order to manufacture Miura 5. Because in terms of space, we were in a very small warehouse where we can fit Miura 1, but we realized that Miura 5 is not fitting in that in that warehouse. So we are doing a lot of changes in order to incorporate more space for Miura 5 and all the process that we have to make in the company, but also to incorporate more people. So probably still growing the company, and it's one of the challenge. I mean, obviously after the successful flight of Miura 1, there was a tipping point as well in terms of attracting people. Because we were growing before the Miura 5, but it's still very not easy to convince people to join a company as PLD in a pre-flight era. But after Miura 1 flight, I think there were a lot of talent that they just see PLD is a very attractive company. We are based in a fantastic place in Alicante, one of the regions in Spain with more sun days. The beach is 10 minutes from the factory. Food is fantastic there. We have all the ingredients to attract people into that place.
I was going to ask you about it. That makes perfect sense. You are literally almost on the beach. And so even though, to my knowledge, there's probably not the big technical universities, obviously, in other cities in Europe, but it's certainly a very attractive place to move to.
In the last time, we were able to also import some people from the US that it was very difficult to have it before the Miura 1 flight. But now after they visit us, they see the facilities, they see the rocket, and they see the lifestyle in Elche, in Alicante, where we are based. They are in love with the place and they like to be there. They want to participate in this nice history.
So as we're winding down here, just two or three more questions for you. One, which I should have asked at the beginning, I realized I forgot. What is actually the origin of the name PLD?
PLD means payload, aerospace. So PLD are like a contraction of payload. So basically we were incorporating that word as a part of the company objective.
Gotcha. And so before I move to our sort of usual closing questions, anything else that you would like to point out about PLD that we haven't touched upon that you think is important for listeners to know?
Well, I think we were across all the history and all the future milestones that I think give the listeners a good idea about PLD. So basically, everything is quite exhaustive. So
good stuff. Okay, so our last two questions are always the same. The first one is, so you're now at PLD, obviously very exciting for a launch company in Europe, but you have obviously an overview of the space sector in general. Is there anything else, other space activity, other space business models you find very interesting or attractive?
Yeah, well, I have a couple of things that I like very much because I've been in the space sector, has been in the last 2-3 years, but previously I was working with different type of companies developing different type of technologies, more related to IT. And nowadays, I think there are a couple of things that are very attractive as a watcher of this evolution. Obviously, artificial intelligence is one of the things that is moving a lot of things. There is also a lot of hype. I really see that there is some very practical artificial intelligence that they are gonna create a lot of innovation in the future. But it's shocking the number of times that everybody, all the companies are mentioning artificial intelligence in everywhere. So basically, not everything is artificial intelligence. But this is one of the common, but also I'm very excited about the combination from artificial intelligence and healthcare. So companies that are using artificial intelligence in order to improve life of humans are very, very interesting. And I see a lot of, I have been in contact with so many companies that they are developing this type of technology that it really amazed me how the things are changing and evolving in this combination between artificial intelligence and health of human people.
Our last question is always the same, which is basically about science fiction. And so do you like science fiction? Which, of course, I hope. And if so, what would be some of your favorites? So it could be books or movies or TV shows.
Yeah, well, science fiction, I mean, I have a very good, nice experience during this Easter time with my kids, watching again, I don't know how many times I watched those movies, Back to the Future, which is still one of my favorites. And it was shocking because in the third movie, there were those, or in the second, there were those cars flying over the roads. Mm-hmm. And one of my kids was born in 2015. And one of the dates that they were appearing there is that it was in 2015. So one of the kids asked me, but this is not happening right now. I mean, the cars are not flying. And that movie is saying that in 2015, the cars were flying over the roads. And I say, well, this is science fiction. And sometimes... The times are moving in different ways. I mean, the imagination of the humans are incredible, but sometimes I don't think we are far from that, but we didn't meet the expectation of my kids because they were saying if that movie was saying that the cars were flying in 2015, why they are not flying nowadays?
And then you can bring it back to the space sector and explain to your kids how by now we landed on the moon the last time in 1972 and we thought we'd be on Mars by now and have a moon base, and stuff just takes more time for a variety of reasons, and it's real life. But José Manuel, thank you so much for taking the time today and talking about PLD. Best of luck with the rest of the journey of PLD. We really looking forward to having an orbital launch in Europe. So best of luck with all of that.
Thank you. Thank you very much for hosting me in this podcast. And I hope all the listeners enjoy the history of PLD and hopefully they will be following us in the coming events, because it's going to be a couple of years that is going to be very exciting for the company and for the European space industry development as well.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for another nominal episode of the Space Business Podcast. If you like this podcast, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, such as iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at podcast_space. Also consider supporting us at www.patreon.com/spacebusinesspodcast. If the podcast got you interested in learning more about the business opportunities in the space economy, check out my new online course on space entrepreneurship on udemy.com. The link is in the episode description. Lastly, if you have any feedback, including ideas for guests, and that may include yourself if you have an exciting space story to tell, or interested in being a sponsor, drop us an email at spacebusinesspodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to seeing you for the next episode.